Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Sarah Abel, who is the author of the book, Permanent Markers, Race, Ancestry, and the Body After the Genome, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Dr. Abel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm delighted to have you on the podcast, and I can't wait to talk about your book, Permanent Markers, which examines the racial politics of DNA testing. And so I wanted to just begin with a question we normally start with, which is, how did you come to write this book? And can you tell us about yourself, anything about your background and what sparked your interest in genetic testing and race?
Sure. So the book's based on my PhD research, which I started 10 years ago now. And it was part of an interdisciplinary and international research network called Eurotest, which received funding from the European Commission. And this network, the idea was to bring together geneticists, bioinformaticians, archaeologists, historians, and anthropologists to look at the histories and legacies of the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans at the intersections of the biological and social sciences. And while various of the sub-projects were about using genetic methods directly to shed light on the population history set in motion by the transatlantic trade and slavery as an institution, the project I ended up taking on was about looking at those genetic methods and tools from a social perspective. So how they were being used to think about issues of race and identity, what were the ethics and epistemological limitations of those practices. And with regards to my own background, just before I began that PhD, I'd been doing a master's project in Latin American studies. And I was doing a dissertation on the impacts of the Haitian Revolution on forms of Black identification in 19th century Cuba. And I was kind of enjoying doing this historical approach, but when I'd actually gone to Cuba, I couldn't get access to the archives, and I spent a lot of time just talking to people and realized I really enjoyed that more kind of more of an interview, more of a contemporary ethnographic approach. So when I saw the call for applications for the Eurotest project, that was actually probably one of the first times I'd come across the idea of genetic testing. It's not something that I knew a lot about. And I was really intrigued on the one hand by the idea that these tools were being used to explore the continuing impacts of slavery and colonization on notions of race and kinship today. And at the same time, as someone who had been trained in the constructivist social science tradition, this idea of using genetics to reconstruct racial and ethnic identities in this way seemed kind of sacrilegious. I was also really interested in mounting a critique of these technologies, even if actually over the course of doing the research, my ideas about the relationship between identity and genetics, or more broadly, identity and the body, changed quite drastically. And I just want to mention as well that while I was doing the research for my PhD and for the book after the PhD, quite a lot of the people I interviewed or came across assumed that I was a genealogist myself and that that was how I'd come to the topic. And as a matter of fact, I had very little personal interest in family history research. And although I ended up taking several DNA tests over the course of the project as a way of understanding how they worked and having a kind of immersive experience of the phenomenon, I initially found it quite difficult, I have to admit, to understand the excitement and the passion that genealogists and DNA test takers, particularly in the United States, that they expressed about the possibility of uncovering new information about their family histories. But over the course of the research, I began to see that this indifference that I felt about my family history was in part symptomatic of my own racial position. So that is, I would say, an unambiguously white person pretty much anywhere I go. And in my native country, the UK, I grew up with the privilege of never being challenged or questioned on my ancestry or national belonging. So that was one thing that I think was kind of behind that that sort of ambivalence about family history from my own experience. And the other thing was that when I actually began to question my family about our genealogy, I found that what initially seemed to be indifference in the sense that I got the impression that we don't talk about our family or our ancestors because they just weren't very interesting people, I realized after a while that this was actually a strategy for covering up painful and shameful family secrets. And I mentioned this because these turned out to be key insights into how processes of racialization create not only diverse affective relationships to ancestry and genealogy, but also different material and structural possibilities for people to access those histories.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And thank you for situating yourself, your positionality in that way. And that's also interesting that you got to kind of try out these different methods, like archival research versus ethnographic research, and make that choice to kind of see what you're getting yourself into. I would have loved that.
Yeah.
So great. So your book is looking at these DNA ancestry tests, and as you just said, and these tests are becoming relatively ubiquitous, at least in the United States, as you also indicated. And I just had a friend who I saw in the summer, and he showed me his genetic ancestry tests and, you know, showed me the different percentages. And of course, in the United States, we'd also be familiar with these various commercials that are trying to sell us these ancestry tests to take them. And so they appear to hold the key to our identities in that they tell us, you know, what percentage we are of these different regional backgrounds. And so I was wondering, how are you intervening in our understanding of these genetic tests? And what are you arguing about the social and racial dynamics of these tests?
Right. So in the book, I look at the tests from various different angles. The kind of first part of the book looks at how they're portrayed in culture, in particular in documentaries or special reportages. I'm not sure which is the right one. So looking at how they're kind of presented, how these discourses are presented to the public. Then I look at them more from the kind of scientific point of view. So I look into the scientific construction of some of the different DNA ancestry products that are available on the genealogy market. And in particular, I have a chapter that's devoted to the, as they're called, the genetic ethnicity tests that are currently sold by Ancestry.com, which is currently the global forerunner in terms of the amount of sales of DNA ancestry tests. But that product's also quite similar to ones that are offered by 23andMe, MyHeritage, and other big players. And one of the things that I noticed when I was looking at the advertisements for these products and the way that they're often presented in popular culture is that they companies tend to present genetic knowledge, as you say, as indisputable and also universally true. That's to say that there's this idea that a test will supposedly work as well for someone in Brazil as in the United States, as in Korea, as in Kenya, and so on. But one of the key points that I make in the book is that the tests are actually constructed with particular publics in mind, and that's usually inhabitants of the United States, who are the Again, the global leaders in consumers of genetic tests, and in particular within the United States, they're aimed kind of first at white U.S. Americans, and then also African Americans and I think to some extent Latino Americans. So they're aimed at these publics, and they're configured in a way that will reflect the demographic histories of these specific populations in a fairly kind of reasonable way. But as a result, the test won't hold up as well for someone who lives in Brazil or Korea or Kenya, for example, because the test simply isn't calibrated to reflect these populations' histories. I mean, that is to say, you may get a result that seems sort of okay, but you might not get the same amount of resolution on the result, or it may not be as accurate because the reference populations that are used aren't necessarily calibrated for populations in places that aren't broadly the United States and maybe Europe. So that's thinking about how the tests are set up scientifically and how they're marketed. But another issue is the conceptual tools that we all bring in order to interpret the test results. And the third part of my book looks particularly at how members of the public are engaging with these tests and the readings that they bring to them, how they understand the results in relation to what they already know about their ancestry. In the book, I consider two contexts, the United States and Brazil. And what this allows me to do is to show that even if two people, say one Brazilian and one US American, were to receive identical test results, they would likely have quite different interpretations of what they meant in terms of each person's racial identity. And this is because we all bring culturally specific scripts to our readings of genetic data. So the most available readings that we bring are usually to do with the way race and ethnicity are framed within national identity discourses. In Brazil, for example, this relates to discourses of mestiçagem, racial mixture. And in the US, it's usually in reference to the one drop rule. But people can also bring multiple other cultural and racial scripts to bear on their DNA ancestry data. And this kind of results in a variety of readings, which are sometimes even in conflict with one another. And in the book, I follow other researchers like Alondra Nelson, Nadia Abu-El-Hajj, and Wendy Roth, among others, in exploring how the tests are understood and mobilized by members of the public in relation to not only diverse societal discourses about race, but also in relation to the different ways we individually are racialized in society. For example, based on how other people identify us, relating to, for example, our skin color or other kind of physical markers that are racialized. Also in relation to our prior knowledge of our family histories, our sense of cultural affinity, and other things. So in particular in the book, I focus in on the subtle choices that test takers make in terms of assimilating some aspects of their results and setting aside or rejecting others, to try to show how test takers make assessments about how valid or accurate their DNA data are, rather than simply accepting them wholesale.
Mm-hmm. Great. So thank you for that. And so I'm going to pick up where you mentioned during the past answer. You said you compare genetic ancestry testing in the United States and Brazil. And so I wondered why you pick these two countries particularly, and, you know, what made them, you know, such fertile ground for your study?
Well, for centuries, the United States and Brazil have been constructed both in international discourse and in their own national discourses as essentially racial opposites. So this goes back to the 19th century and even beyond. But in the 19th century, during the rise of international eugenics movements, the United States was heavily invested in protecting the so-called purity of its white populations and did this by eradicating or segregating as far as possible its native and black populations. And it became admired by Eurocentric governments around the world for those efforts. Brazil, on the other hand, was regarded internationally as somewhat a racially backwards country because of its history of what was seen as unbridled racial mixture since colonization. But around the mid-20th century, against the backdrop of the Second World War, Brazil managed to successfully rebrand itself as a country that was free of racism. And that they kind of posited this as being due to the way that the country had embraced racial and cultural mixture as the core of its national identity. And on the other hand, the United States' program of Jim Crow segregation was regarded internationally as a failure. And ever since then, the US has been perceived as a country with racial problems. And one of the assumptions that you often hear when people are talking about genetics and genetic testing is the idea that DNA testing will help people be less racist because it shows how mixed we are. And this common sense idea that mixedness is kind of antithetical to racism has been fundamentally strengthened over the years by this very dichotomous image of mixed race Brazil on the one hand as the country of racial democracy and the segregated United States on the other as this country of acute racial problems and neuroses. But having said that, like other Latin American countries in recent decades, Brazil has been forced to come to terms with the fact that this dearly held notion of mixture has in fact work to pull a veil over the deep-rooted and systemic forms of racism that have produced and perpetuated inequalities between the country's white and non-white populations. So I think that, first of all, the case of Brazil has some really important lessons to show us about why simply believing that we're racially or genetically mixed really isn't sufficient to drive a meaningful anti-racist agenda. And I think this is an important critique of genetic claims to anti-racism that really needs to be more widely understood. And another thing that I hope to achieve in the book was to place into dialogue the practices and experiences of African Americans in the US and Afro-Brazilians who are seeking to recover aspects of their family histories linked to slavery as a way of seeking racial justice. So one of the things that mestiçagem or mixed race discourses in Brazil have done is to encourage individuals to selectively forget aspects of their family histories, and in particular, Black histories, as a way of trying to racially whiten themselves and their descendants as a way of kind of improving their position in society. And this means that traditional genealogy hasn't usually been seen as Afro-Brazilians as a viable route to recovering aspects of their ancestry or to shedding light on how slavery affected their family histories and how that violence has echoed through the generations. But in the United States, on the other hand, Black genealogists have been able to use genealogy very fruitfully, not only to begin to recover the identities and stories of their enslaved ancestors, but also to challenge the national discourses that claim that racial mixing only occurred rarely, if ever, under slavery. So drawing on these different experiences, I try to suggest how careful interpretation of genetic and genealogical and other types of historical research, if it's done with a critical lens, could be used to challenge dominant discourses about race and racism and national identity, and also to pursue forms of epistemic justice for the descendants of the enslaved.
Great, thank you. And you, in the book, you really do go into such like historical background about the two countries and why you chose them. And in particular, I learned in your discussion about racial mixture in Brazil. I also do research in Brazil, but I was not aware of the origin of the term miscegenation and that it came from, that it was a pseudoscientific term that came from the United States during the Civil War to spread alarm among white liberals about the impacts of racial blending. So I had no idea about that. So that thank you for that, as well as much of the other insights that you bring to bear on these, you know, histories and understandings of mixture between the two countries. And so, as you mentioned, too, you have this like kind of three-pronged approach in the book where you look at representations of this testing, the perspectives of the scientists, and the perspectives of those people who take the tests. And so I wondered, from the perspective of the scientists, from their point of view, they seem to be very careful about how they presented the genetic findings, and they seem to want to avoid the political or ethnocentric use of such findings, of these ancestry tests. And so I wondered, what were the scientists so concerned about, and how did they navigate this conundrum of the I guess, political landscape in which these tests were being taken up?
Yeah, so I should distinguish immediately between the research scientists who I think are the group that you're particularly referring to, and on the other hand, there are research scientists who've kind of crossed over into the world of commercial DNA ancestry testing, who maybe didn't have the same concerns, or they felt that being able to get out these data to members of the public was went beyond any of these more kind of ethical concerns. But so among the research scientists I interviewed for the book, almost everyone I spoke to was very critical of commercial DNA testing. I'd often hear it described as junk science, as just, you know, nonsense, as charlatanism. And particularly the people I interviewed were disturbed by the way that companies encourage members of the public to construct or to reconfigure their ethnic and racial identities based on genetic information. Part of the problem that many geneticists, or I should probably say many white geneticists in particular, encounter is that they're very invested in the idea that genetics can offer a singularly privileged and objective viewpoint on issues about origins, ancestry, and diversity. And this is supposed to be a vision that exists outside of political arguments, individual desires, or market dynamics. Of course, from a social science perspective, this is just nonsense. Of course, geneticists bring their own desires, their own conceptual frameworks, their own politics and biases to their work, just like anyone else. But this belief is also what gives genetics its reputation for being such an incisive tool against racist ideologies. So to abandon that belief is also to cast doubt upon the ability of genetics to kind of cure the world of racist ideology. So many of the research geneticists I interviewed, particularly in Brazil, were nervous about any sort of public use of genetic data that could contribute to the construction of collective identities. But they weren't good at distinguishing between the power dynamics at play in identity movements. For example, differentiating between attempts at the reconstruction of identities among groups who have suffered cultural trauma like slavery and enforced displacement on the one hand, and on the other, the use of genetic data to reinforce white nationalist forms of identity, for example. And my view on this is that geneticists really do need to be more politically and racially literate. They need to perceive and understand the power dynamics at play behind identity claims, and they need to take a more robust stance on anticipating and refuting racist and oppressive uses of the data that they themselves are producing and disseminating, even if they see this as very different from what DNA ancestry companies are doing. There are, in my view, are essential continuities in the way the data are produced and the conceptual frameworks that are being used. But I should say that the attitudes I came across among Black geneticists were somewhat different. So they often felt that genetics did have something to contribute in terms of rejecting the biological basis of race and giving a more expansive account of human diversity. Some of them also thought that genetics could shed light on African and African American population histories and origins in the context of the history of slavery, and they believed this information should be made available to the public. So while they were invested in deconstructing concepts such as race and ethnicity, and they wanted to frame their data in ways that would resist the geneticization of these identities. They also wanted to present the data in a way that they could be used genealogically to help shed light on the identities of the enslaved ancestors of African descendant root seekers.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so picking up on this idea of genealogy, I guess, I was going to, you know, bring this up where, as I was reading your book, it made me think about this time when I spoke with a genealogist. And I know you said that you would be constantly mistaken, you know, for a genealogist, and you're, you know, you're not one. This person who I talked with, that was her job. She tended to help people to find their, you know, their family tree, if you will. And so I remember her saying that African Americans and Jewish people were generally the hardest for her to trace, due to, I think, the transatlantic slave trade and the Holocaust, I think, for Jewish people. And so those, you know, those events made it difficult to trace people back to a certain point. And then at a certain point, everything, it was almost impossible to get beyond it. And so in chapter 3 in your book, you talk about, you know, the instability of these tests and how sometimes like white people could align their genealogy information with the test findings, but, you know, African Americans could not. And so I wondered how did this differential access to genealogy impact the use and experience of the genetic testing?
Right. Well, so what I talk about in part of that chapter is how genealogists in particular, and in particular white and Eurodescendant genealogists have kind of contributed to the functioning of commercial DNA ancestry tests, because they kind of test out the results by checking them against their own pedigrees and genealogies. And they'll often send feedback to the company if they feel like the ancestry estimates are getting it wrong, basically. Whereas this is not always possible for people of African descent. And I came across various different strategies that people use to deal with this this kind of epistemic instability of the tests. So in the United States, there is a large network of African American genealogists who've built up an incredible amount of expertise in terms of conducting genealogical research in the context where much of the written archive is either incomplete or inaccessible, or it's of questionable reliability because the documents were written by slaveholders and not enslaved individuals themselves. So if you were to go and take a look at the blogs of prominent African-American genealogists, of which there are many online, you'll probably find a fairly standard set of guidelines that they suggest following if you want to get into family history research. So almost all experts will emphasize the importance of starting in the present, where the kind of facts are more stable. You know, you can ask people, interview people, and start working backwards in time. They will suggest using genetic data to triangulate other sources about the past, such as oral history and written documentation, but they will generally not suggest that you, for example, start with a DNA test and then try and do your research in such a way as to work out, work out from the DNA data backwards. They will not suggest you taking the DNA test as an authority in itself, but rather it's something that should complement other sources of research. Having said that, for individuals who want to trace their ancestry to their family origins in Africa, so beyond slavery, it then becomes much more difficult to find oral or written sources to support their genealogy. And in these instances, DNA test results often take on a much greater weight. So something that often happens is that someone will get a DNA test result and then they'll perhaps go to the country, one of the countries that shows up in their DNA matches, and they will perhaps see people who look like them, or they'll notice patterns or products that reminiscent of things that they always use, they remember their grandmother using, for example. And these kind of coincidences are often experienced as a confirmation of the validity of the DNA match. This is kind of the level of traces are being used, these disparate traces, to try and get a confirmation of the DNA match. But at the same time, I was often struck while I was doing my interviews by the amount of times that test takers would ask for my personal opinion, I guess as an expert, on the validity of the result. I mean, I can't offer that opinion because I'm not a geneticist, but also I think that there's the DNA result is necessarily contingent, but this feeling that an absolute certainty about one's origins was always just out of reach was definitely something that that I noticed among a lot of the African American root seekers that I spoke to. And in a sense, I guess you could argue that's, you know, can you ever have certainty about the past? You know, particularly when you're talking about something as fluid and multifaceted as identity. But on the other hand, I understand this desire for certainty because it's rooted in the violence of the erasure of the identities of the enslaved. So it's a desire for a reparation of what was taken. And in Brazil, the situation is likely to be even more tenuous because in Brazil, there's not the same infrastructure as in the United States for people to be able to just go online or pop down to their local family history center and access their genealogical documents. The Brazilian government actually took the decision to burn its fiscal documents relating to slavery at the time of abolition as a way of making sure that there wouldn't be claims against them by slaveholders. So their kind of official line has been just erase and forget. And for that reason, traditional genealogy really isn't seen as an option for Afro-Brazilians to trace their African ancestry, although there have been a couple of interesting projects in recent years that try to go in that direction. But as a result, in Brazil, where commercial DNA testing has only really started to take off in the past 5 years or so, I tended to see rather an overconfidence in the ability of DNA tests to help recover an ancestral African identity. And this is perhaps similar to what happened in the United States when DNA ancestry tests first became available about 20 years ago. There was a huge amount of initial enthusiasm among some African-American circles, but this gradually became tempered as people became aware of the methodological and epistemic limitations of the tests.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I wanted to then shift the question to how people responded to the test, or how, and particularly how your Brazilian respondents interpreted their ancestry results. And I asked this because you were doing the research during a considerable shift in Brazil around racial categories, and arguably these shifts are still taking place in that. And I think you mentioned this too, ideologies of race in Brazil found that everyone was of mixed race, and these are shifting now to the embrace of more stable racial categories. And of course, this is being propelled by affirmative action policies and policies to teach Black history and culture in Brazil. And you have the Black movement, who's also advocating for, you know, Black consciousness. So it's a dynamic, you know, setting. And so into this situation comes these genetic ancestry testing. And so I wondered how your respondents in Brazil made sense of the findings that they received.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, as you say, I was doing my research, my fieldwork in Brazil in 2012, shortly after the national quotas law was ratified. And although there was a sense of distinct fatigue around the topic of affirmative action and so on, it was definitely a really interesting time to be asking questions about race and identity. At this time, there wasn't a genetic ancestry testing market in Brazil as such, although there was in the US at this point. And the idea of DNA testing wasn't really that well known to the general public. So what I did for my research was to approach an international genetic study called Candela, which had recruited volunteers from various different countries, including Brazil and Latin America. And it was interested in understanding the links between genotype and phenotype in mixed Latin American populations. So they gave me access to some of the participants who'd taken part, and in general, volunteers who took part in the study were offered a fairly basic admixture test as a kind of reward for taking part in the research. So what I did was to interview a subset of these volunteers after they'd received their ancestry results. And I was interested in seeing how those DNA results compared to their beliefs and expectations about their ancestry. And one thing I just want to mention is that whereas in the US around the same time, we were starting to see the appearance of these fine scale DNA ancestry tests that would break down your ancestry into different kind of intracontinental countries or regions, the Candela test results in Brazil related to just three continental groups. That's African, European, and Amerindian. And this is partly due to economic concerns, because it wasn't cost effective for the project to give out very fine scale DNA tests. But it was also because it reflected what the researchers believed were the basic components of Latin American ancestry. So there's already this kind of constraint on the possible results that this test could give to the volunteers. So almost all of the volunteers in Brazil that I interviewed had the expectation that they would be mixed, and that was just seen as common sense as being Brazilian. But they were particularly interested in seeing how much of each continental ancestry they had. And this very quickly became translated into racial terms. In other words, how Black or white usually a test taker was. And one of the interesting things that I observed was that although Brazil, it was supposedly renowned for having a very fluid and flexible schema of racial identities, which might lead you to think that as people are receiving this DNA information, they might change their racial identification. In fact, I found this was very rare. In fact, most Brazilians had a very complex and multifaceted conception of their identity. So they knew before taking the test that ancestry and color, which is the kind of term for race based on physical appearance that is very ubiquitous in Brazil, they knew that ancestry and color were not the same thing, because many people come from families where siblings and parents and children look very different. And this is seen as the notorious effect of mestiçagem. It's seen as mixing up racialized physical characteristics in this crazy or incomprehensible way. So that formed part of their common sense. Most of them appreciated that in their daily lives, it wasn't ancestry, but rather color or physical appearance that was the most important factor in how they were perceived racially. So they understood their identity as having various components that weren't necessarily concordant. So on the one hand, how you look, on the other, your family background, your personal sense of cultural or political affiliation. And now, in addition to that, you could also look at your DNA ancestry results. And it's worth saying that the DNA ancestry results didn't always seem to align with what people thought they knew about their family and their family ancestry, which was usually based on the color or racialized appearance of their relatives. So people would look at their results and say, oh, that's so weird, because I have an ancestor that we all call, like, we all know as the grandmother who was like an Indian from the forest, because she had straight black hair. And yet there's not very much indigenous ancestry in my results. So people would kind of puzzle over that kind of calculus of how color corresponded or didn't correspond to genetic ancestry. And although I found that the Brazilians I interviewed had quite a stable sense of racial identity, it's worth mentioning that a few of the people I interviewed had the expectation when they took the DNA test that the results might be useful if they wanted to apply for affirmative action. And this was often people who described themselves as pardo, which is a kind of mixed or sort of intermediate category in Brazil. And most of the time they were disappointed. So they were perhaps hoping for a clear majority of African or Amerindian ancestry, but usually what they got was a slight majority of European ancestry, which they either felt didn't really clarify their racial identity or it wouldn't be useful for backing up a quotas application. And I just want to also mention that whereas in the United States, DNA testing has been quite enthusiastically taken up by some African-American communities as a way of tracing their African ancestry, in Brazil, this type of usage has only begun to happen in the past few years, really, and has been impulsed by the anti-racist movements of the summer of 2020. So this is after I finished writing the book. But there were some cases of newspaper and magazine reports that used DNA testing in the early 2000s in the context of the debates around affirmative action. And they used DNA to ostensibly find something out about the African ancestry, for example, of a group of famous Afro-Brazilians. But what tended to happen was that these reports ended up reinforcing the claim that Afro-Brazilians are just as mixed as anyone else. And since this discourse has been used time and time again to try and veil the effects of racism upon Black Brazilians or to deny the need for compensatory public policies, at the time I was doing my fieldwork in 2012, most of the Afro-Brazilian activists that I interviewed were actually very wary of engaging with DNA testing, as they'd seen that the results could very easily be used politically against them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is fascinating. So my next question is about your research and the processes that you use to gather data. And I wondered in particular how you familiarized yourself with the terms of scientists. And I ask this in the context of how we're often, you know, we talk about learning a field language as anthropologists, like such as, you know, the Portuguese language, but it also seemed like you had to learn another one of your languages was like a scientific language. And you use, you know, different scientific terms like haplotypes and things like that. And so I wondered, was it challenging to enter into this world of scientists? And, you know, is there anything else you found particularly interesting or challenging about doing the research for this project?
Yeah, definitely learning about the genetic concepts that I deal with in the book was quite an undertaking. It wasn't close to anything I'd studied in a long time, probably not since high school. So I was keen to try and at least understand the principles of population genetic theory, which necessarily meant understanding the technical terms to do with the process of DNA ancestry testing before I started out on my fieldwork, partly because I felt that this would allow me to be taken more seriously by the geneticists I interviewed, because there was already quite a lot of, I was perceiving a lot of animosity towards social scientists from geneticists. There'd already been a number of critiques published of genetic ancestry testing by social scientists, and the geneticists that I met and knew were often a bit dismissive of this. Like, they felt like the social scientists hadn't really done the work, or they perhaps didn't really understand what they were talking about. But one of the things that really helped in my process was being part of the Eurotest network that I did my PhD through, because I had a lot of opportunities to discuss and debate those concepts in depth with my geneticist colleagues and friends. And I actually published an article with a colleague that was kind of alongside writing my PhD thesis. And it was a very, very challenging exercise just trying to establish a common vocabulary between someone coming from a social science background and my colleague who was coming from a geneticist background. But at a certain point in the project, I remember that my PhD supervisors began to feel that there was a risk of me going native. And they started to warn me that I needed to pay less attention to the genetics and you know, really take more of a kind of distant social science stance on the phenomenon. So I found it was quite difficult to reconcile the desires of my social scientist advisors with those of my geneticist colleagues with regards to the critique that my thesis ought to make regarding genetics and its relationship to issues of race and identity. So the geneticists wanted me to critique the DNA ancestry testing industry, but they were less receptive to criticisms of mainstream population genetics, even though I found there to be a fundamental continuity between the two. And on the other hand, the social scientists wanted the project to underline the social constructedness of race and to deconstruct the legitimacy of genetic data as a source of identity knowledge. But this was also a problem because it kind of led me to feel like I was delegitimizing the practices of the many people that are using genetic data to try and reconstruct their personal histories and to, you know, as part of these racial justice projects. So that didn't sit comfortably with me either. So in the end for the book, I engaged with biocultural theories that understand race instead as being constructed using elements encompassing both the social and the biological. And I think this is a useful framework because not only it allows us to take seriously the way that DNA data are being used to negotiate and construct racial and ethnic identities today, but it accounts for the way that racial boundaries have always been constructed through the management of bodies, and in particular the management of sex and reproduction in the context of slavery and colonization.
That's interesting. It's like the perils of interdisciplinarity and the different goals of the different people and all of our trainings and, you know, the kinds of questions that we think we're supposed to be answering. What happens when those worlds come together and collide and how do we reconcile them? That's interesting lesson in that. And then one can also see that, I guess, in the book as well, which I'm sure readers will like to see is, you know, how do you bring this social science view to, you know, to the sciences as well and bring those two together. So this is interesting because you just said that you took this approach that race is social and biological, and then you just kind of described that. So I guess maybe this will help me think about like my next question. And so I'm just interested in your response to it, because in thinking about this genetic ancestry testing, I kept thinking about one of the difficult challenges of teaching about race, which is to teach the idea that race is a social construct. And that becomes very difficult, I find, for students to grasp, right? And as anthropologists, you know, we're always putting forward this idea, you know, race is a social construct. Yet in the book, you had people who were generally not anthropologists, who were trying to undo race with scientific ancestry. And so you came across many people who would say, oh, these genetic ancestry tests can help us undo kind of the, you know, like the perils of race, of like racial inequality and racism. And And so, but this idea is kind of contradictory because it doesn't necessarily undermine the idea that race is biological, but rather, you know, reinforces this idea of race as biological, which is, again, is something we're usually trying to deconstruct. So I just found this tension, I guess, throughout the book. And I was wondering then, like, just what you thought about this idea of, you know, of how race is being talked about in all of these different ways.
Yeah. First of all, I want to be super clear that I approach race as a biocultural construct in my work. So when I say it spans the social to the biological, I want to be really clear that I'm not suggesting that there are both, kind of, on the one hand, the socially constructed aspects of race, and on the other hand, there's a biological component which is natural and innate, which is what some people argue. I think that's wrong. What I'm referring to is the fact that race has always been, and racial difference, and this is something that I think is discussed in a really clear way in Peter Wade's recent work, Degrees of Difference, Degrees of Freedom, which is this this issue that race is already, and racial difference is has always been reproduced through the management of bodies. And so here the social precedes the biological and not the other way around. So I just want to make that super clear. And then going back to your question, I think there's at least two points here. One of them is a point that Catherine Nash has made in her book, Genetic Geographies, which I also draw on in my book, which is that DNA ancestry tests in the way that they're currently presented seem to convey the message that although we're all human and we're all mixed on some level, here are these populations shown in your results, which are the ones that you're most closely related to. And there's this kind of idea that because you're more closely genetically related to these particular populations, you should care more about them. And by the way, these results don't summon up images of diverse multicultural populations. No, they summon up a fantasy vision of these ancestral populations that are more or less ethnically pure. So Nash argues, and I agree, that DNA ancestry in this form is not a solid basis on which to construct a meaningful anti-racist project, because there are these kind of hierarchies that are so available within the way that the ancestry results are presented. And the other thing that I encountered during my research was people, again, often white people, who embrace the rhetoric that we're all genetically mixed and biological races don't exist according to genetics, because they felt that if everyone was just to accept this genetic knowledge, then people, and by this they meant people of color, would have to just stop banging on about racism. So these genetic discourses that reinforce biological equality become a way of silencing and delegitimizing the real violence and inequalities that are still perpetuated by structural forms of racism. And this same logic was used in Brazil during the debates around university quotas to cast doubt on either the legitimacy of Black Brazilians' claims about racism and inequality, or the very claim that any quotas policy could ever work. So it was used in a way to suggest that that quotas would inevitably fail because it was simply impossible to come up with an objective way of defining who the beneficiary should be, because even if someone looked Black, then but genetically you might find that they were completely mixed, or even, you know, had more European ancestry than African ancestry. So this was a tactic used to confuse and kind of delay public policies that aimed at repairing these social inequalities. So I think for that reason, personally, I rarely go to that place of being like, look at genetics because this will explain how we're all the same and therefore no one needs to be racist. I think it's quite a weak argument, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to your point of the title of the book, Permanent Markers, the permanent marker, I think you're arguing, is that it's like slavery and colonialism, like those
exactly,
are the markers
yeah.
that are defining. Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Precisely, it's this idea that even if we're living in a world where supposedly a large kind of proportion of the population recognizes this genetic truth that that races don't exist, we're still compelled to look to DNA ancestry tests and try and try and scrutinize our own ethnic and racial makeup through this lens of genetic ancestry. And I think the reason that is because we're still dealing, or rather not dealing, with the legacies of slavery and colonialism. So as you said, the permanent markers that I'm referring to are really the way that those experiences have marked us as societies that we're still grappling with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So the last question I have, I guess, about that pertains to the book is, I had to ask this question about kind of the nefarious uses of people's results and if that ever came up. And I've talked to people, myself, just people I know about these ancestry tests, and they always bring up this question of, well, what are they going to do with the results? And should I do these tests? Because what if they take the results and do something, against my own interest with them? And many of the people I'm talking to are African Americans. And so, there's this, history of, experience with surveillance and racism. But other people could have that, that perspective as well. And so I just wondered if this ever came up throughout the research or with any of your interlocutors when you were looking into these ancestry tests.
Yeah, definitely. And this is something that researchers like Dorothy Roberts and Duane Fulwiley, among others, have written about in really compelling ways. In particular, in the United States, when I was looking for participants in my research, I would ask people that I met through my field work whether they'd taken or thought about taking a DNA test. And I did come across a lot of African Americans who had the stance that you mentioned, that they were curious, but they were at the same time wary of what the results might be, or what the data might be used for. And I think that that's with good reason, to be honest. So I didn't really address this directly in the book, because the people that had that positioning had not taken a DNA test, so I didn't end up interviewing them for the project. But on the other hand, I did the people that I did end up meeting and interviewing in terms of African American DNA test takers, people who'd taken a lot of DNA tests, were often genealogists, and they tended to be of an older generation, often middle class, quite comfortably off, so possibly the risks felt more remote for them. And I think it's also interesting to point out that the majority, as far as I can tell, of people who take DNA ancestry tests are white and Eurodescendant people, Americans and probably Europeans. It's hard to get solid numbers on this because companies don't tend to divulge that kind of, or perhaps they don't collect that kind of data, who knows, but they, they don't divulge that anyway. And I think definitely when you talk to white and Eurodescendant people, this is usually quite far from their preoccupations. So this is also the customer base that has made these companies so successful. So I think it's interesting to see that the kind of power that these companies have thrives on the fact that white people who don't have these same concerns of racism and surveillance are very happy to give their data. And what is often said among people who study DNA testing is that even though you think you're paying for a service, really you're giving away your DNA, and that's what companies make such a lot of money on. They're not making the money on the price of the DNA test. They're monetizing your data collectively. And with regards to Brazil, again, as I mentioned, commercial DNA ancestry testing has only recently taken off. And so far, I haven't seen much critical engagement with this aspect about privacy and the ethics of these industries. And I think at minimum, there should be pressure put on companies to be transparent about their privacy protocols, how their data are used, who has access to them, how they plan to protect customers' privacy in the face of possible law enforcement requests. This is still, even though there's been some efforts to have companies make transparency declarations about those kinds of things in the United States, it's not always clear, for example, what companies would do if approached with a warrant from a law enforcement agency. And also, even if they have those protocols, there's nothing to stop law enforcement agents from simply submitting a DNA sample and logging on as a regular customer. There's no way of telling how often that happens or what's being done with that kind of access. And obviously they wouldn't get access to the entire database by doing that, but they would be able to access kind of a pool of, suspects. So this is definitely something that's quite difficult to get a purchase on the magnitude of risk here or really to get a sense of what are the possibilities for what might happen to your data in future.
Mm, wow. Thank you for that enlightening answer about those tests. So my last question is for you. And so now that Permanent Markers is out into the world, what projects are you currently working on or do you have on the horizon that you're thinking about?
Yeah, thank you. So since finishing the book, I've been working on a new project about representations of skin color through art and science in the context of contemporary anti-racist movements in Mexico. I'm really lucky to have funding for this from the British Academy. And the idea for this project came from when I was doing my PhD research. And I found that in places like Brazil, when I spoke to Afro-Brazilian activists about the possibility of using DNA testing as a kind of anti-racist tool, they were not that excited about it because they said that color and not ancestry was the real issue when thinking about racism and in terms of tackling people's perceptions of racial difference and behaviors of discrimination. And at the time that I was doing my PhD, the findings of the project on ethnicity and race in Latin America, or PERLA, which is led by Edward Tellez at Princeton, had just been published in the book Pigmentocracies. And they used this color palette as a way of trying to gather data about the way people are racialized and how this correlates with patterns of socioeconomic inequality in Latin American countries that have historically denied the existence or importance of racism based on the claim that everyone is racially mixed. And I noticed that the color palette has really taken off in Mexico since Pigmentocracies was published. It's been used in a number of government and research surveys about intergenerational mobility, and it seems to have been quite influential in terms of sparking national debates about racism. So what I'm interested in is understanding how these visual technologies are constructed and what is the work that they do discursively in terms of visibilizing racism relating to skin color. So from a position of working on how racial difference is perceived as residing in the body in our DNA, I'm now moving on to looking at how racial difference is constructed on the surface of the body in mestizo societies.
Hmm. Well, we will look out for that. So that sounds like a great bridge from one project to the next. And so good luck on that research that you're currently underway in doing in Mexico.
Thank you.
Great. So I have been speaking to Dr. Sarah Abel, the author of the book Permanent Markers, Race, Ancestry, and the Body After the Genome, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing it with us on the podcast.